And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. While this nation is focusing on its primaries and caucuses and finally, a year from now, getting rid of George W. Bush. And by the way, it's just a year and 3 days. A year and 3 days. And finally, we get a new president. But meanwhile, our dear, beloved George W. Bush was in the Middle East. What was he doing in the Middle East? Well, he decided that after 7 years as president, where he was going to remake the Middle East in his image, after saying he didn't want to do any nation building in 2000, you know, since 01, he's going to remake the Middle East in his image, he decided to actually visit the place. Okay, that's pretty good. He'd spent a total of 15 hours in Iraq, and now he's going to visit Israel and the Palestinian Authority and Saudi Arabia and Egypt. What was he doing in all of those places? Well, in Saudi Arabia, he was begging. He was figuratively on his hands and knees. Actually, he was in these very large fur-lined robes that the Saudis provided for him, holding the prime minister, the king, whatever, the king, the princes, holding his hand, as is Saudi custom. I often wonder if a Democrat did that, what would Rush Limbaugh say, particularly a gay Democrat. But in any case, he's holding his hands, wearing fur-lined robes, doing everything but going in drag, begging the Saudis to lower oil prices. And the Saudis said, and let's see if I can get the direct quote here, they said, oh, where is that? Yes, they will lower prices when the market justifies it. In other words, no. So Bush decided to do what America always seems to do in this situation, give out the arms. The president is discussing giving $30 billion of arms to Israel, $20 billion of arms to Saudi Arabia and the other Arab countries. But here's an idea, Mr. President. Don't arm either side, since the arms are probably going to be used against each other. But, heck, that would hurt our military complexes that make so much money off of those arms. In any case, he's there. He's begging the Saudis. He's saying, please, please, oil prices hurt the American people. One thing that I really appreciated, in fact, that Hillary Clinton said in the Nevada caucuses is when she talked about how pathetic it was that our president was going around the Middle East on bended knee begging them to lower the price of oil. The one thing the president doesn't seem to consider, though, is whether or not we should be the Saudis' lackeys at all. Maybe it's not a good idea to have our United States of America owned by an autocratic prince who leads a country where women have fewer rights than any country in the world. Maybe Saudi Arabia shouldn't own America. Maybe we shouldn't have the massive debts that cause our Saudi owners and our Chinese owners to have more and more control over us. Maybe, just maybe, we should wean our way out of oil. Well, the president sometimes says we shouldn't be addicted to oil, but he's, of course, very clear that his policies want to make us more and more addicted. And after all, this is a president. He and his father have been very, very close to Saudi Arabia for decades. The stories of Bush and the Saudi royal family are legion. Most Americans don't know it, though I know the Horn audience does know. That, for example, when young George W. Bush was high on cocaine, had a severe drinking problem, was getting in physical fights with his father, George Herbert Walker Bush, and had been arrested and convicted, not just of drunk driving, but of things like fighting and stealing. At that time, his oil business, given to him by his father, you know, which is really nice, you know, to have daddy give you a multi-million-dollar oil business. Here you go, son. He was failing. He had messed it up. He seemed to find the only dry oil wells in Texas. But the Saudis came in to help. Yes, the Saudis. apparently not having enough oil of their own. I mean, the Saudis had many, many oil fields in Saudi Arabia that were plentiful with black gold, that were overflowing. The one thing the Saudis didn't have was a dry oil well in Texas. So I guess just to increase the novelty of it all, they decided to go to the son of the president and to buy out his dry oil field, saving Arbusto, Spanish for bush, get it? Spanish for bush. Buying Arbusto and making sure that the poor Georgie Bush didn't lose his shirt. It was from that that he bought that money, provided by the Saudis, that let him buy the Texas Rangers, and the rest, as they say, is history. But here he is, back in Saudi Arabia, a country he's done so much to help. A country, as Bob Kincaid never tires of pointing out, and he's always right, that where not only Osama bin Laden came from, but where Osama bin Laden was chartering a plane to send some people back in his family after September 11th. Michael Moore, of course, has emphasized that in his movie Fahrenheit 9/11. The point is that George Bush has been close with Saudi Arabia for a very long period of time, and now we're going to sell them some $20 billion of our very best weapons. Now, what does Saudi Arabia need these weapons for? Who is out to attack Saudi Arabia? I mean, arguably, before 1991, Saddam Hussein was a threat to Saudi Arabia. He invaded Kuwait. Of course, invading Kuwait is very different from invading the much larger Saudi Arabia. But okay, prior to 1991, Saddam Hussein was a bit of a threat. We control Iraq now. Heck, we control Kuwait now. We're on their borders. Who's a threat to Saudi Arabia? Who else borders Saudi Arabia? Jordan? Jordan, that tiny little country of Jordan, eastern Palestine, one of the most Western-friendly countries in the world, although it also is a dictatorship, a more benevolent dictatorship than some others. It's no threat to Saudi Arabia. Who's a threat? Yemen? Qatar? All those little United Arab Emirates? All those little extremely oil-rich countries on its nether regions of Arabia? They're a threat? No, they're not. They're Sunni. Frankly, they're much weaker than Saudi Arabia. Why does Saudi Arabia need arms? And where will those arms eventually go? You know, we did sell arms to Afghanistan, or to the Mujahideen specifically in Afghanistan, to try to fight the Soviet invasion back in the 1980s. Jimmy Carter sort of woke up to the problem when the Soviets invaded, and I don't know whether you can say he overreacted or not. Certainly the Soviets were no friends, but neither were the Mujahideen, who Carter and then Reagan armed. But they got the arms, and eventually Osama bin Laden got the training that he would later use against us. So who's taking the arms in Saudi Arabia now? Who is a threat to Saudi Arabia? Meanwhile, the Bush administration is going to Israel as well. Unlike Bill Clinton, who spent every day, really until the very last day he was in office, struggling very hard to get some kind of deal, some kind of arrangement between Israel and the PLO, and finally learned to his chagrin after pushing Israel really, really hard, actually making Israel give up huge swaths of its capital, Jerusalem, the holiest Jewish city. That Arafat wasn't interested in a deal. Arafat wasn't interested in the Palestinian state. Arafat had no concern for the sovereignty of the people he claimed to represent. He didn't want them to live in peace. Arafat had hundreds of billions of dollars in Swiss bank accounts. Well, millions, hundreds of millions, probably in the billions. And frankly, if he had to run a state and worry about potholes and worry about intra-Palestinian Arab conflicts, well, he wouldn't be that popular anymore. So when Israel offers him 95, 96, 97%, Arafat never even comes up with a counteroffer. May he rest in non-peace and shame. And yet, Clinton tried. He truly tried. George Bush, well, he let them be. And, you know, to some extent, I don't know that a U.S. president can ever solve the Middle East crisis. I don't know. I think it has to, at the end of the day, come to where the people themselves want to resolve it. And I'm not so sure anyone has an incentive to. I mean, you look at Hamas down in Gaza, okay? The world had argued Israel must withdraw from Gaza. They should withdraw from Gaza. That there'll be peace if they withdraw from Gaza. They withdrew from Gaza, and lo and behold, the most radical, murderous Arabs in the region took control and are busily, right now, every day, shooting hundreds of missiles onto Israeli soil. Not a very good incentive to encourage Israel to leave any other territory. But Hamas is very happy. They have Gaza. They have ended all democracy there. They were elected back in 05, but I guarantee you there won't be another election. They have run out their alternative. Fatah made sure that they are a one-party state. And the people in Gaza live in complete misery. But the Hamas rulers don't live in misery. They're the ones who live by, after all, taking advantage of everyone else. In other words, we've created a brutal dictatorship where one didn't exist. So why would Hamas ever stop trying to destroy the state of Israel? That's how they get their legitimacy. You have to remember that if you look at dictators, whether it be Stalin or Hitler or, heck, Assad in Damascus, they usually get their legitimacy by attacking a foreign enemy. If there's peace, then people look and say, well, why are you ruling us so harshly? So Hamas has really no desire to make peace. Compare them, for example, with Egypt, another country that George Bush visited. Egypt did make peace with Israel, and now the Egyptians are not worried about Israel. They're worried about Mubarak, the leader of Egypt. The people of Egypt are extremely upset with their government, a brutal dictatorship that, by the way, gets billions of dollars from the United States every year in weapons. Why are we aiding Egypt? Who's going to invade Egypt? Libya? Sudan? Certainly not Israel. Why does Egypt need our weapons? No, Egypt uses our weapons to harass its own people, to throw newspaper journalists in jail, to make sure that Mubarak is dictator for life. What is the difference, I ask you, between Mubarak and Saddam Hussein? Both are brutal dictators. Both kill their own people. Both jail their own people. Oh, and both were aided by America. Well, there is a difference, of course. Saddam Hussein, we stopped aiding a few years back when he turned against us. Mubarak hasn't turned against us yet. We continue to give him aid. And for all the presidents talk about democracy, there doesn't seem to be any discussion of democracy in Egypt. We'll take a break if you want to join in and say anything about Bush or the Middle East or the confluence of the two. Please give us a call, 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We'll be right back after this.
This is the Head On Radio Network.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It wasn't exactly planes, trains, and automobiles on Head On with Bob Kincaid.
This is what the Bush administration Justice Department didn't want you to see back in 2001. They took out and they huffed the marker a little bit, and then they went, oh, cool. And they wiped out the name where it says the plane was chartered either by the Saudi Arabian royalty family or Osama bin Laden. Somebody's got to call up and say, good afternoon. Thank you for calling Ryan International Flights. How may I help you?
Hello.
This is Osama bin Laden, and I would like to rent a Boeing 727. Do you have one handy? Oh, just a moment. Let me check.
It's a Mr. bin Laden wants to know if we got a 727. Do we, Harry, do we have a 727?
Yeah, we got a 727 just sitting there on the lot. Going cheap. There's nothing here. Nothing to look at. Keep moving. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, the, you know, the 6'7" Arab with the portable dialysis machine and the white robes.
Somebody's trying to make me stay, you know I've got to be moving on.
Head On with Bob Kincaid, weeknights 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern, only on the Head On Radio Network.
If you or someone close to you has a hearing loss, here is some great news. Thousands of Open Caption videos are yours to borrow, and it's all free. Open Caption videos make it possible for the hearing impaired to understand television. The Caption Media Program offers classic Hollywood movies, special interest, and educational videos. Visit us online at cfv.org or call 1-800-237-6213. You can register to be a user and make your selections from our online or printed catalog. It's just that easy, and we'll even pay for the postage. Open Caption videos are perfect for the classroom, your home, or even the workplace. The nonprofit Caption Media Program is funded by the U.S. Department of Education and administered by the National Association of the Deaf. Tell a family member or a friend about the Caption Media Program today. Bookmark cfv.org for free loan Open Caption videos or call 1-800-237-6213.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop, talking about Bush in the Middle East. If you want to call in and add your two cents, it's always good to hear from you. In fact, it's good if you call early, because then we have time to talk. I don't have to cut you off at the end. Toll-free number, 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. Some of you want to comment on the blog. I know some of you would prefer to write rather than call. That's okay, too. Go to RadioInsideScoop.com, and I'll read some of your comments on the show. So, when George Bush goes to the Middle East, he learned an amazing lesson that apparently he just didn't know. He was shocked to, and surprised to find out, as he told Terry Moran of ABC News, quote, "I mean, my image is Bush wants to fight Muslims, and yeah, I'm concerned about it," unquote. Quote, "I'm sure people view me as a warmonger, and I view myself as a peacemaker," unquote. Really? Really, George? You don't understand why they see you as a warmonger? I mean, he really seemed to be surprised. People think Bush wants to fight Muslims. What could possibly have caused people to think that? Let's see, maybe the fact that we invaded a country that never attacked us? That could be it. That could well be it. You know, the fascinating thing about the entire Middle East is it's always fun to imagine that, let's say, the oil were found in Africa or in Southeast Asia or Australia, for that matter. If there were no oil under the sands of Arabia, would we ever care about that region? Well, the best way to know the answer, of course, is to look to Africa. Africa is also the remnant of a colonial past. Africa was also divided into crazy boundaries with straight lines by European colonial powers. And, you know, usually straight lines are a sign that something's not quite right. The reason why Europe has so few boundaries with straight lines is because they're linguistic, ethno boundaries. If you speak French, you're pretty much likely to be in France or, you know, small areas of Belgium and Switzerland. Same if you speak German or English or Spanish or Portuguese. There are countries, Spain and Portugal, Italy, and they have languages and similar cultures, and there's a reason for that. And there's a reason why the borders are kind of ragged. And Europe fought each other for hundreds and hundreds of years to get those borders. But the European colonial powers drawing up the borders in Africa and in Asia just kind of drew some lines, sometimes for crazy reasons. The British, for example, have wanted to attach Afghanistan to China, not because Afghanistan has any real connection to China, but because they wanted to prevent the Soviet Union from bordering Pakistan. So when they drew Afghanistan and Pakistan, they made this little line. Look at Afghanistan sometime and see the little eastern peninsula that makes absolutely no sense on the map. It goes through craters. There's just no reason for it. But, hey, the colonial powers had their reasons. And I think it's always useful in history to go back to a time when the Jews of Judea and the Arabs of Arabia were allies in the region. I was doing some looking back in some history to the time when all of the Arab lands, when all of Judea and all of Arabia and, frankly, Syria and all those other lands were under the control of the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottomans, of course, ruled over the area from about the 1500s up into World War I. So it had been pretty much the status quo for about 400 years. And after World War I, well, actually, I should say before World War I, a lot of people were fighting against the Ottomans. The Ottomans, by the way, controlled a lot of Eastern Europe, too. Bulgarians did not want to be under Ottoman rule. Hungarians did not want to be, well, they were part of Austria-Hungary, excuse me. Romanians did not want to be under Ottoman rule. The Greeks did not want to be under Ottoman rule. That's why the Greeks and the Turks still fight today. And the Jews didn't want to be under Ottoman rule, and the Arabs didn't want to be under Ottoman rule. So the Jews of Judea and the Arabs of Arabia got together and actually signed an agreement. It's the famous agreement between Faisal and Weizmann, Chaim Weizmann, who would later be president of Israel, and King Faisal, who would later be the king of Arabia before there was a coup and the Sauds. The House of Saud took over Arabia from King Faisal's Arabia. They signed a deal, and the deal would basically give Israel the territory that it has today, plus the West Bank, the Golan Heights, and a little bit more, actually, parts of Lebanon and parts of what's today Jordan. And the Arabs would get all the rest. And the idea was the Arabs didn't have a state. There was no such thing as an independent Arab state under the Ottomans. There was no such thing as an independent Jewish state under the Ottomans. There are many, many more Arabs than Jews, so the Jews would get their small portion of the region, and the Arabs would get the lion's share of the region, and they agreed to work together for independence. And then when came World War I, and the British and the French were fighting against the Ottomans, the Jews and some Arab groups, including the tribes that of the Hashemite dynasty, joined with the British to fight the Ottomans, so the Arabs could get independence, and the Jews could get independence. And you may know some of that story with Lawrence of Arabia, when you had the Arabs joining with the British against the Turks. In any case, World War I happens. Britain then sets up a Jewish state to be called Palestine, an Arab state to be called Transjordan. And they have some problems, namely that Faisal is installed as king of Arabia, but the House of Saud comes and kicks him out. Britain never really thought about a local tribe, taking over where Britain was installing people. Britain also installed the first king of Iraq and drew the Iraqi boundaries, a king who was later overthrown in a coup in 1958, and then later on in another coup, Saddam Hussein would take over. And so these two brothers, the Hashemite brothers from Faisal's family, who helped Britain when one of them got kicked out of Arabia, he was given the booby prize, which was Transjordan, carved out of what was supposed to be Palestine, and that would be the Arab state. So it's just fascinating to me as you look back into all of history and you see the boundary lines drawn by the European powers. And it's no wonder that people are left to fighting each other. I mean, the same thing exactly happened in India and Pakistan. Of course, for those who know history, know that India and Pakistan and Bangladesh were all one country. Again, it's the Brits again. They control this whole thing, British India. And then when the Gandhi does his wonderful nonviolence and encourages the British to leave, they leave. There's immediately a civil war between the Hindus and the Muslims. Eventually, the Muslims declare themselves in Pakistan and East Pakistan, which later becomes Bangladesh. And the Hindus are in the country of India. And at that time, tens of millions of Muslims leave their homes in India and move to Pakistan so they can be in a majority Muslim country. and tens of millions of Hindus leave what were their homes for hundreds of years in Pakistan and move to India. And India and Pakistan are still not the best of friends today. You may know they're fighting very hard over Kashmir. Both of them are nuclear-armed powers. But yet, you really don't see much of the world jumping on one side or the other. Partly it's because, heck, they're very, very large countries. I mean, India has more than a billion people. Pakistan's also an extremely populous country. But we're not so much worried about the Pakistani-Indian conflict. We are much more concerned about Pakistan and the way it helps, to the extent it does help Osama bin Laden and helps al-Qaeda. You don't see the whole world jumping on that conflict the way they do still jump on the conflict between Jews and Arabs over this tiny little area of Judea. And the reason for that, I would suggest to you, is the same reason why George Bush is in the Middle East to begin with. It's called oil. Three letters, oil. We don't care about fights between India and Pakistan, except that they're nuclear-armed powers. We certainly don't care about fights in Africa. In Darfur, there's genocide going on. George Bush has talked a little, and he's spoken extremely softly and carried no stick to try to stop what was going on in Darfur, which is a case of actually Arab Muslims killing African Muslims. We don't seem to care much about those Arab Muslim terrorists, and they're committing genocide. Nor do we care very much in Liberia when we have an African dictator so brutally mistreat his own people that he not only kills his political opponents, but he forces their children at age 10 and 11 to join in a children's army. Meanwhile, we fundamentalist Christians like Pat Robertson make a lot of money from Liberian diamond mines. He doesn't seem to care much about human rights either. No, the difference, of course, is that the Middle East has oil. And the irony of all of this is that we don't have to have an economy run by oil. Already, alternative fuel technologies are sprouting up everywhere except the United States. Oh, we have a little bit. We've got a few hybrid cars. But I've talked often on this program how Brazil has 40% of its fleet run on sugarcane. On the fact that I've been in a car that runs on soybeans, and I'm told that switchgrass works even better. And yet, as we discussed yesterday, Republican candidate Mitt Romney would have us lower fuel efficiency standards. Think how much money we have to spend to prop up oil, and how much less money it would cost to go to an alternative resource. To prop up oil, we don't just pay $100 a barrel oil prices. It's not just that we give subsidies like in the energy bill, $85 billion a year to the richest corporations on earth, Exxon, Mobil, and the like. No, it's the $1 trillion we spend on a war in Iraq. And if you scratch the war in Iraq a little hard, if you ask the supporters of the war in Iraq a little bit more, and you get them to admit that, of course, there were no weapons of mass destruction, and you ask them why we're really invading Iraq and why we can't leave as the Democratic Party candidates ask us to, they'll tell you, well, then we won't have a lock on oil. So what does that lock on oil cost us? $1 trillion. Thousands of American lives. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqi lives. Tens of thousands of Americans wounded. Millions of Iraqis exiled. All so that we can fill up at the pump. And yet, there are alternatives. Let's take the $1 trillion we're spending in Iraq and just spend a hundredth of it, $10 billion. Heck, even a tenth of it, $100 billion. $100 billion on focusing on alternative energy. $100 billion investment into how to get crops we grow from the ground to run our cars. How much cheaper would that be? And we wouldn't have a president who has to go to the Middle East and hold the hands and kiss the rings of some of the most awful dictators on earth. It's a dream, I know. But it's the only way that the Middle East won't matter. And then we can truly focus on things like human rights and democracy and all the other things that George Bush claims he supports, but when push comes to shove, he never does. Toll-free, 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. I'd love it if you join in the discussion. Please do. You can feel free to agree or disagree with anything I'm saying, or ask a question, or make a statement, whatever you want. You can also comment on the blog at RadioInsideScoop.com. We'll be right back after this.
This is the Head-On Radio Network, The Horn.
Harry Potter has given us all a unique glimpse at education the way it ought to be. Never once do Harry and his Hogwarts friends talk about skipping class, ducking tough instructors, waiving requirements, or shirking responsibilities. That perspective, be practical, get it the easiest, fastest, cheapest way you can, is what J.K. Rowling terms the Muggle approach to education. We're Concord University, and do we have a deal for you? At Concord, education's different than anywhere else around. There's a reason that Concord students get the best jobs, are sought out by the best medical, graduate, and law schools in the land. It's no wonder that Concord has been cited by U.S. News & World Report and by the Wall Street Journal. Where do I sign up? At Southern West Virginia's version of Track 9 and 3 Quarters, all you have to do is believe, and believe in yourself. Concord University, an education you can put to work. 1-888-384-5249.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. One of Hillary Clinton's favorite tropes is to claim that she has 35 years of experience as an agent of change. She cited that figure at least four times in the Las Vegas debate, and Bill Clinton touts it on Hillary's website, so let's take a look. To her credit, she does have a long history of working for children's rights and women's rights. But that's not the totality of her record. 32 years ago, she joined the Rose Law Firm in Arkansas, which represented such change agents as Tyson Foods and Weyerhaeuser and Walmart. Hillary herself represented the utilities against the grassroots group Acorn, and she was Coca-Cola's lawyer against a disabled veteran who was denied full benefits from the company. She was the agent of something, but I wouldn't call it change, when she then joined Walmart's board of directors. And was she a change agent in the White House when she and Bill abandoned their friend Lonnie Guinier, who'd been nominated to be the first black woman to head the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department? As a senator, she hasn't exactly been a change agent, unless the change you like is the Iraq War and the Patriot Act. When you look at her boast of 35 years of experience for change, there's much less relevant experience and much less progressive change than meets the eye. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
Here's the guy changing the way you hear music, Billy Shears.
Tune in to Night Sounds every Saturday night, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern. You'll hear the latest in new music releases, special segments like One Hit Wonders, Under the Covers, and Night Sounds dedications with the sassy and classy Erica Richards. For requests and dedications, direct your email to nightsounds@billyshearsmusic.com. So tune in and stop by the chat room this Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Hey, thanks for lending an ear.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop, discussing Bush in the Middle East. If you want to call in, the toll-free number is 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. R. Duke in the chat room points out that we shouldn't just talk about switchgrass, we should talk about hemp too. He's right, there are a number of different resources. Imagine if this government, just $1 billion, just 1/1000th of the cost of Iraq, were to put money into weaning us off the Saudi dictators that own us. Just imagine. Meanwhile, as I said, in Egypt, as you look at countries across the Middle East, the amazing thing is that here, when they try to justify the war in Iraq, after we learned that, you know, no weapons of mass destruction, no connection to Al-Qaeda, at least none before the war, none before we invaded, they seem to always bring up democracy, right? The neocons, it's all about a new Middle East, all about remaking the Middle East, all about setting Iraq as a beacon in the Middle East. And there are people who claim to really believe this. I mean, I think some of them are just, you know, laughing and taking their oil stocks to the bank. But I do think there are people who are true believers. Paul Wolfowitz is probably one of them. I don't know. Maybe not. But he certainly talks as if he believes that we can create this wonderful democratic polity in the Middle East. The problem in the Middle East is that it's very hard to create democracy from nothing. It's very hard to create democracy from a land without a middle class. If you look at the Middle Eastern countries, you can see that, for example, in Egypt, you have a pretty brutal dictator supported, again, by the United States, and a mass of extremely poor people, some of the poorest in the world. Cairo is a teeming city, and they're quite unhappy with their government. Now, don't get me wrong. You can have poverty and you can have democracy. India, I think, is an amazing example of a long-term stable democracy with quite a lot of poor people. But India also has a middle class. Heck, a lot of those middle class people in India are the ones that are taking American computer jobs. But you can't deny their success. And that's one of the reasons why India's democracy stays in place. But when you have, in essence, kingdoms, sheikhdoms, tribal leaders, and you have a mass of people at the top who are rich and everyone else who is poor, it's very hard to have democracy without revolution. In Saudi Arabia and the Arab Gulf states, you have an extremely rich people at the top, and generally you have people who aren't citizens who are working for that country. You have a two-state society where you have Saudi citizens getting all kinds of benefits, but the other Arabs who live in the country, whether they're Egyptian or Palestinian or from anywhere else, they have no rights. And heck, the Saudis don't have that many rights either, certainly not the Saudi women who can't even drive. But anytime you have a society of the super rich and everyone else is poor and you have no middle, and you have no free press, and you have that kind of crackdown, it's very, very hard to become a stable, functioning democracy. We can look at European history, look at the French Revolution, to see how hard it was. France had to go through some pretty terrible convulsions. And the comparison of that with the quite bourgeois American Revolution, where you had, you know, upper-middle-class, white, slave-owning Americans fighting upper-middle-class, white, slave-owning Britishers, but with a little bit of freedom thrown in, you know, a little bit of radicalism with Thomas Jefferson and a certain Declaration of Independence. But it was still a fairly bourgeois revolution. It was not a revolution of the poor against the rich, the American Revolution, not in the least. It was a revolution about, you know, self-determination, right? We should rule ourselves and not being controlled by Britain. When you look at transitions to democracy, I think you'll find, whether, again, you can compare the Russian Revolution or any of the great wars, that it takes time, and it takes a functioning middle class. And it's not easy to do from a dictatorship. Now, there are examples. The examples that I think of, for example, come from Asia. You look at a country like South Korea, a country that had a dictatorship, that had a threat from North Korea, and has slowly transformed into a democracy. Largely, I would say, because at that time they were working on an economy based on middle class, based on education, based on hard work, but not based on a bunch of, you know, rich people owning all the means of production and controlling everything. I mean, the sheikhs of Saudi Arabia and the oil countries, they're more likely to be in Monaco gambling than they are actually working in their countries. They live, for all the discussion of the word apartheid, I think it most properly applies to these Arab countries because you have these two groups, right? You have the non-citizens and the citizens. The non-Saudis are not allowed to become Saudis, And the Saudis, definitely, if you're part of the royal family, I mean, it's just like the old feudal French system, frankly. It's not a distinction among cultures. It's not a saying European culture is better. It's simply understanding the way a monarchy works, a feudal monarchy. And the way that Britain became a free country is by slowly taking away the monarch's powers, the Magna Carta in the 12th century on, and becoming a constitutional monarchy until, frankly, the Queen of England is someone we can all gossip about but has virtually no power. And to do that, we have to press these Arab countries, our allies, to democratize. And George Bush claims to agree with me on this, right? He claims to want to do exactly that. And sometimes he even uses a little bit of rhetoric. But there's a problem. They've got us by the cojones. They own us. Saudi Arabia owns us. China, too, by the way. They own us. As we go more and more into debt to finance this war, to finance all the rich people who give so much to the Bush campaign and to the Republicans, the Saudis buy more and more of our treasury bills. We depend on them for everything. If they cash in those bills, oh boy, massive recession. If they raise oil prices, oh boy, massive recession. They own us. What are we going to do, default on our debt for the first time in American history? If we don't get away from oil, and Bush, of course, is doing nothing to do that, they own us more and more each day. There's a reason why George Bush was wearing the fur-lined robes and holding the Saudi prince's hand, and I don't think it's because he's gay. No, I'm sure George Bush wouldn't do that with another leader, an African leader, one who didn't own us. But they do own us, and therefore we have to give them everything. There's a reason why we did nothing about Saudi Arabian involvement in September 11th, even though 15 of the hijackers came from Saudi Arabia. They may have been trained in Afghanistan, but they came from Saudi Arabia. They attended madrasas, those Islamic schools that are teaching, by the way, not all madrasas are radical, but some of them teach radical anti-American rhetoric. Where do they think they came from? They came from Saudi Arabia, and they were financed by American oil money. We finance both sides in the so-called war on terror. We finance our troops who are fighting Al-Qaeda, and we finance Al-Qaeda as well. And yes, every time you fill up your Hummer or your SUV, that money goes into some sheikh's pockets who will give it to some radical training center in some terrible portion of the globe where they are training people to hate us. And then George Bush says, I don't know why they hate us. We do two things. First, we fund schools that teach people to hate us. And then we go to preemptive war and show them that they should hate us. But here's the dirty little secret in the Arab world. The great majority of people in the Arab world are under 30. The great majority. Mostly because, you know, this huge oil revenues come in. Until then, they were mostly tribal regions living, you know, in the poverty that, frankly, people live in Africa and Asia and other third world nations. But there's this massive population explosion financed by our oil. And the children don't have jobs, don't have a future, and are taught to hate. It's a time bomb, and it's ready to explode. So how do we reach out to Muslim young people? Well, one way to do it, frankly, would be with a new president by the name of Barack Obama. ELO writes in the chat room, and she means it as a joke, but it's not exactly a joke, that Barack Obama attended a madrasa too. Now, obviously, he did not attend any radical Islamic terrorist madrasa, but he did go to school in Indonesia. He attended Catholic schools, and he did attend schools that were secular but majority Muslim. Barack Obama, just by having lived in Indonesia for 4 years, even though he was a little kid, 6 to 10, he, I think, has an understanding of the world that George Bush never had. He's someone, I think, just by virtue perhaps of his brown face, but also by virtue of his uplifting rhetoric, I mean, this is a guy who really talks about bringing this country together. I think he could talk about bringing the world together. Now, I don't expect him at all, let me be clear, to affect the Arab dictators. I don't think the Arab dictators will suddenly have tears running down their streaks and singing the Star Spangled Banner and I Love America. That's not going to happen. They get their power out of controlling their people, brutalizing their people. For all the discussion of, oh, the Israeli-Palestinian crisis is the center of the Middle East, no, it's not. No, it is not. Talk to an Egyptian. Ask the Egyptian whether he cares more about Mubarak and the way that he's running his dictatorship in Egypt, or whether he cares more about where the line should be between the West Bank and Israel. He cares more about Egypt. And the same is true in Iraq. They care more about their country. And the same is true in Saudi Arabia and Oman and UAE and Syria and Lebanon and you name it. And that's not insulting to them. It's just that the people themselves care about their own countries. That's understandable. And in these countries which are teeming with young people who often see no hope, no future, they care about their governments. And what are their governments are saying? Their governments are the ones who are saying, oh, well, we can't have a democracy in Egypt until Israel solves its problems with the Palestinian Arabs. The Saudis, we can't give rights to women until Israel solves its problem with the Palestinians. Iran, we can't stop arming Hezbollah, which has taken over Lebanon, which used to be the Paris of the Middle East, until Israel solves its problem with the Arabs. I say it's a load of crap. I say that this is an excuse used by dictators to stay in power. You know, the Russians didn't much like Stalin. But when Hitler was fighting Stalin, they stood up to Hitler to defend their country. I mean, that's when people support dictators. Heck, that's why we're supporting Bush, right? I don't mean we in the horn. But Americans rallied around Bush when we had an external enemy. The same was true in the Soviet Union. The same was true in Hitler's Germany, supporting him because of the League of Nations and the Treaty of Versailles and the French. It's very easy to support dictator powers when you have an enemy. George Bush understands that. The Arab dictators understand it the exact same way. But what if we had a new president? And it doesn't have to be Barack Obama. I mean, Hillary Clinton or John Edwards would be leagues better than this one. But just for a second, imagine a Barack Obama, someone who represents a minority in America, someone who lived abroad for a few years, someone who could say, we are not the America you knew. We don't believe in preemptive war. We don't believe in attacking a country that has never attacked us. Yes, we want to wean Americans off of foreign oil, but we have no designs on your soil. We need no military bases in Iraq. Someone who could say, we support your right to democracy, meaning the people, the massive people of that region. And it's going to be tough. I mean, there are countries like Pakistan that have a history, on and off to be sure, but have a history with some form of democracy. They have had elections. They're having trouble now. But at least they have that. And the Arab countries that have zero history of that. There's not a single democratic Arab nation. There are democratic Muslim nations in Turkey and Indonesia, and as I say, Pakistan has a history back and forth, but none in the Arab world. So how do you develop this sort of liberal Arab polity? It's not easy to do. Many of the people who are against these governments, whether in Egypt or Saudi Arabia or Syria, are the radical Muslims who hate America even more than their governments. Their governments, after all, will sell out to us if we give them arms and we help support their dictatorships. But the people, it seems, are only the radical Muslims. That's why I think the Palestinian example is so interesting. Because there you have truly divided the two. You have Hamas, the radical Muslims, if you will, the ones who want war for war's sake, and always want war, and will want war because war is their very justification for existence. Hamas cannot exist without war. How can it mistreat its people in Gaza so badly without war? It is. There's a reason why it's raining missiles every single day on Israel. Because it wants Israel to attack back, because it wants perpetual war, much in the way that some neocons want perpetual war in the United States. It keeps them in power. It'll be interesting if we see the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank take another way. I do believe that Mahmoud Abbas wants another way. I don't know that he's powerful enough. And so we'll have to see what happens. But if he can come to some kind of deal to show the Palestinians of Gaza, the Palestinians of West Bank will live a lot better in peace, then that, I think, is the kind of thing that really could start the democracy in the Middle East that the neocons talked about in Iraq but won't succeed there. It's an extreme uphill battle. Fatah is very corrupt. It comes from Yasser Arafat and the whole tradition of this, you know, corrupt organization taking a lot of money and putting it away. So I don't know if Abbas can do it. But I'm hopeful he can. Because if not, this can really go on for another 50, 100 years. It can go on for 200 years. Unless the Palestinian Arabs are willing to accept a state, and the state may only be 90% of what they want. 90% is pretty good. They need to get that. And they need to do it before the people become even more radicalized than they already are. George Bush put up a new question with Israel, saying that he thinks that the Palestinians that left in 48 should get compensation, the Arabs who left Judea in 1948. And, you know, I guess that's okay as far as it goes. I think he's got to be fair. He has to give the Jews who left Arab countries in 1948 the same compensation. I mean, more Jews came into Israel from Arab countries than left Israel to go to Arab countries. It was about the same, but a little bit more. There was about 800,000 Jews kicked out of Arab countries. I mean, the majority of Israel, of course, it always bears repeating it. They're not Europeans and they're not Americans. We hear the Americans because they speak English. The majority of Israel are Jews kicked out of Arab countries. Well, what about their compensation? I think it can go either way. I think you either compensate both or you let sleeping dogs lie. The same is true with India and Pakistan. I mean, you're going to compensate the 20 million people in each place? It's not easy to do. You could, or you could let it lie. The real heart of the question, though, I think, is giving people something to live for. To give the young people of the Middle East something to live for. They have such extreme wealth because of our dependence on their oil. But the they is not the people of the Middle East. The they is the sheikhs of the Middle East. It's the monarchs. It's the people in power. It's the less than 1% that control everything in the Arab world. They have huge amounts of money. They make Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, I think, look like pikers. And what are they doing with that money? Oh, they're building lavish palaces. I forget whether it's Saudi Arabia. I think it was Dubai that built the indoor ski rink in 120-degree desert land. That's right. You can go snow skiing on man-made snow. Think of the cost of just cooling that massive building in 120-degree heat so that it can support a ski rink. They have no place to put their money. They have so much money. And therefore, a lot of the money is going to teach suicide bombers and to go after the same people that are killing us. Wouldn't it be great if that money could be redirected toward the hundreds of millions of Arab poor and Muslim poor throughout the Middle East? Wouldn't it be great if we had a president that were to say to the Arab dictators, you have hundreds of billions of dollars. We think you should spend it on your own people. We think you should spend it on schools and universities. We think you should spend it on increasing the rights of women, on allowing non-Saudis to be citizens of Saudi Arabia. Think about if we were to give that kind of speech, totally separate from Israel and the Palestinians. and simply say to Mubarak of Egypt, you have tremendous amounts of money. This works out, by the way, even better with the Arabian states, because they really do have far more money than they do in Egypt. Say to Saudi Arabia, say to Oman, say to the UAE, you have tremendous amounts of money. We think you should allow all of your people, to join and enjoy that wealth. Now think about it. Think how the Arab peoples would treat that. They'd be like, huh? The American president supports us becoming wealthy too? Imagine if we had an American president that could join with the dispossessed of the earth against their own rulers. So that if they overthrow their rulers, instead of hating us, they love us. Why do we have such a problem in Iran? Because we supported the Shah of Iran, a brutal dictator, who taught his secret police how to torture people. Yes, the Shah was a great ally of the United States, a great ally of Israel, but when he was overthrown, they hated the U.S., they hated Israel. And frankly, the Persians are not traditionally the kind of people that are particularly against Jews or against Israel, but they did because we supported the Shah. Well, it's just a matter of time. We support Saudi Arabian dictators. We support Egyptian dictators. Indeed, the founding of Al-Qaeda, many people don't know, dates back to the Egyptian Islamic Brotherhood, the same people who killed Sadat, Anwar Sadat. The point is, at the end of the day, the real problems in the Middle East come from our dependence on oil and Arab dictatorships. And either way, we have to stand with the Arab people against their own rulers. Now, I'm not saying this is easy. I never claimed it was. But if we had a president that spoke always about the people of the region and ways to help the people of the region, well, what would happen? Well, Saudi Arabia might not sell us so much oil. The leaders of these countries, they might not like that very much. And given that the Saudi Arabians got us by the cojones, got our economy in their greedy hands, they can destroy us. So it all comes down to oil. It all comes down to finding an alternative to oil. And whether it's hemp or switchgrass or anything else, these little seeds are the source, I think, to practically all of the answers in America. You know, you want to deal with global warming? Get away from oil. You want to get away from the power of big corporations? Get away from oil. You want to get away of this massive national debt we have? Get away from oil. You want to get away from the Arab dictators controlling U.S. policy? Get away from oil. You want to get our troops home from Iraq? Get away from oil. You want to make George Bush and his Texas friends very unhappy? Get away from oil. You know, we don't have to live with oil. The motor engine is only 100 years old. It's time for something new. Imagine America without horses in the 1880s. It's hard to imagine in the 1880s. It's not hard to imagine today. But if we are to plant the seeds of switchgrass or hemp or sugarcane or soybeans, as Bob Kincaid says, they are the seeds of our freedom, and they can grow into our own independence. And the first American president that declares our independence from our addiction to oil, and not just say it, but do it and mean it and spend money on it, will be the first American president who doesn't have to care so much about the Middle East. We can let the tribes fight among themselves, and Americans can come home. This is Mark Levine, signing off.
This is the Head On Radio Network.